The Oracle Network.
Riddle Me That is a true crime podcast that deals with adult themes. Some episodes explore disturbing topics such as murder, abuse, sexual violence, drug abuse, suicide, and self-harm. Please listen at your own risk. Theories discussed in episodes may not be the opinion of the host.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Jules, and this is Riddle Me That, True Crime. So we're right in the middle of the Lavina Lynn Johnson episodes, and I'm fortunate enough to have Black woman studies scholar, educator, activist, as well as wife and mother, Dr. Teresa Lima Neves on the show. Welcome, Teresa.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You're so welcome. So before we get into this, you've got a really unique story in that you came from Africa, but not from mainland Africa, from this beautiful little island country, Cabo Verde. How did you make the transition from this like idyllic island life to being this badass activist doctor in America?
Well, thank you very much for calling me a badass. Yes. Yes, I come from this very small group of 10 islands off the coast of West Africa. And normally I have to explain myself and, you know, where's that again? And normally we're not even on the map. But ironically enough, there seems to be there is a huge population of Cape Verdeans in New England, in the United States, particularly in the states of Massachusetts and Rhode Island, Connecticut. And this is the biggest location for the population of Cape Verdeans outside of Cape Verde, which, you know, historically they came here through whaling. And that's a whole other story that has nothing to do with today. But that's how my people came to the U.S. and my dad came first. And then we followed and built community here. And I'm just grateful that that actually happened.
What language do people speak there?
So our mother tongue is Cape Verdean Creole. It is a fusion of Portuguese, which is our official language. We were colonized by Portugal up until 1975. So we're a very young country. So Creole is what we speak, is the language of the people. And Portuguese is the language of business that you learn in school.
Oh, that's so interesting. Is it crowded there now with tourists?
It's still a little bit of a hidden gem. So I'm still able to go home and find some beaches where, you know, I'm the only one there, or my family and I are the only ones there, depending on what days we go. So, yeah, I was fortunate. I had a wonderful childhood growing up. And with a lot of role models, a lot of women role models in my family, my grandmother. And so it goes back to what you asked me, how did I get into this thing about being a Black feminist, or, you know, just the cause of women's rights and gender studies and all of that. I think that I was lucky enough to be inspired and motivated and encouraged by some really strong women who made do with what they had. And I think I was born into it, and it sort of was encouraged even more when I came to the United States. So then I just sort of took my experience and followed it up with study. You know, so that's why I studied what I studied and why I focus on what I do.
I love that. It explains a lot too. So do you want to tell the listeners a little bit about your background?
Sure. I have a bachelor's degree from Providence College, a master's and a PhD from Clark Atlanta University in Atlanta, Georgia, all in the United States in political science. My particular area of research focuses on Black diasporic African women. So I'm looking at Black women on the African continent and abroad, wherever Black women are. Particularly, I feel that my passion lies in exposing and talking about Cape Verdean women's studies and their experiences, our experiences, our journey, since it is a story that has been told, but to a certain degree. Because we're such a small island nation, often our stories do not get told. And if the stories are told, it's mostly in Portuguese. And I want to be able to have our stories be heard in more languages. And just to really talk about the ways that this group of African women built community, defy, and throw up the middle finger at, you know, patriarchy and misogyny and all that good stuff. Because we do. And so that's really my main mission and what I really love to do. And that has culminated recently in May of 21, I published an edited book with a good friend of mine, historian, Dr. Amina Pilgrim. The name of the book is Cabo Verdean Women, Writing Remembrance, Resistance, and Revolution, Criollas Poderosas. Criollas is another word for Cape Verdean women, and poderosas means empowered woman in Portuguese or in Creole. So our book brings together 21 chapters. That's 21 voices of different Cape Verdean women from different backgrounds. Those who were born and raised in Cape Verde, those who were born abroad in the United States and in the UK and in Portugal. So it's 21 women that are talking about different topics that are not just about gender. The gender analysis is there, right? Because they are women, and but they can talk about any topic, whether it be public policy, whether it be political participation, anything, or feelings and reflection on culture, family. That's what this collection brings, different topics, because we want to be very clear that Cape Verdean women are capable of telling the Cape Verdean story from all the different perspectives. And that's what this book brings to those who want to look at it and purchase a copy. Feel free to go on my website, terzalimaneves.com, or my social media. I'm heavy on Twitter, at Dr. T_Island Woman, at Dr. T_Island Woman. That's where you'll find information on how to purchase my book. So thank you in advance.
I'll link that in the show notes. So if you want to follow Dr. Terza Lima Neves, you can do so on Twitter. And you can also go and purchase her book. So just check the show notes. It'll all be there.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So I've sent you the material on Lavina's case. So before we dig into the specifics, what was your overall impression?
I was absolutely mind blown at the fact that more hasn't been done by the military to really get to the bottom of what happened to this young woman. For me, it was absolutely clear that this was not a suicide. But again, I'm not an expert in that field, but reading the notes, listening to the different interviews, and listening to some experts that have reviewed the notes, whether they be forensics or the pathologist, all the different people who are experts in this, and looking at the pictures, for me, it was clear as day. And it's very mind-blowing to me that we're still talking about it, because even though the case has been considered closed, but there needs to be a resolution. More questions need to be answered. And so there needs to be a resolution to this.
No, I 100% agree. I think the fact that we just got the military period where we've got women whose overseas deaths, only half of them are combat related. That in and of itself is problematic, because sure, some of them can be written off as being something like somebody complete suicide. I'm sure that does indeed happen, but they say half of those non-combat related deaths are under suspicious circumstances. It just feels like the investigation is lackluster, and that there isn't any resolution or justice given to these women, and that there just isn't a proper investigation, and the military closes ranks.
Absolutely. And we know that there's been plenty of precedent and current cases where the military has been mum, right, as it relates to the cases. And we know that there's been a history of just sort of sweeping things under the rug. And so it is no surprise, like we shouldn't be surprised that people like you and I are asking questions, and that the families, they deserve answers, first of all, because we can't just put them in the same box and say, well, you know, it is what it is. But we need to treat them like human beings, the individual cases that they are. And these families deserve answers.
You're absolutely right. And when I went through the main episodes with Dr. Ashley Wellman and my friend Mel, who I had served in the military, and we all came to this conclusion, like, why is the family put in a position that they need to advocate? Like Dr. Johnson and his wife had this talk where she's like, you know, I'll grieve for the both of us. You go and pursue this. They each had their roles. And it's like, the family shouldn't have to do that. He should be free to grieve like any father who's lost a daughter, and trust that the military is going to do their job and investigate his daughter's very suspicious death properly.
Absolutely. And especially when you have a family as close as these folks were, right? So there was a, by this, I'm not insinuating that any other death should not be investigated to this level, to the same degree. But what I'm saying is that this family, they were close. They knew her personality. They knew the types of things that she liked to do. They knew what made her upset and what made her happy. And they knew she was excited about coming home for Christmas. And so they knew that this was not the behavior of their child who was excited about coming home for Christmas, who specifically said, do not put up the tree, do not decorate the tree until I get there. So this does not sound like a child who was a young woman who was suicidal, right? And so if you know your children's, your child's behavior, it doesn't just switch from one day to another. And so even if it was the case that this was a suicide, they still deserved a little bit more courtesy and to have some extra details. But this was not the case.
It just feels like they came to the conclusion of suicide before they'd done any actual investigation. And that's problematic in and of itself. Like, if there's somebody who dies under these strange circumstances, you at least owe it to them and their family to investigate it as a murder. And then if it's not a murder, the evidence will show you that. That didn't happen here.
Right. And it seemed to me that they were very much working to convince us, or to convince the public or the family, that this was a suicide, not so much ruling out anything else, right? And we know that this case happened in the early 2000s, but we see now that there are similar cases where currently the pattern has not seemed to change, that they're saying that, you know, these young people are committing suicide. And a couple of these cases, as we know, more than a couple, we know that they ended up not being suicides. And so if we're working, if we're going backwards, then we can, there's, you know, then they have every right to have some questions. Because yeah. Now we're looking at current cases that have been ruled, you know, homicides. And again, there's just so many questions.
Yeah. And therein lies the problem, right? It's developing this tunnel vision and this narrative before the investigation's been completed. And then after the fact, it's so much harder because all that evidence is lost when you haven't investigated it as a potential murder and let the evidence take you wherever it will. Then you haven't processed the crime scene properly.
And in my personal opinion, that's what happened here.
So let's talk a little bit about statistics with regards to sexual assaults. Like, they're obviously inherently flawed because they only reflect what's being reported and it's impossible to know the total number. But what is clear is that women stand a far greater chance of getting assaulted in the military as compared to civilian life. Are you familiar with the statistics as they pertain directly to Black women or persons of color?
Sure. Well, so it was really interesting with this narrative right here, and I was really curious about it. And then I ended up finding out that the military does not break down their numbers by race. They, you know, so that's what one of the things that I found. So they don't break it down by, like, in terms of, you know, white, brown, or Black, they don't break it down by race. And I think that's one of the things that they need to start doing, because that would really be interesting in terms of letting us know if there's a pattern, if there's a target here, and to ask some questions. Well, why? Why is this happening to predominantly Black women, brown women, white women? So it would be very interesting. But we know that the number of women who are being assaulted is extremely, it's disturbing. We know that men do get assaulted too, but that number is not as high. Well, I can say that for the fact that maybe they're not getting reported, right? Because there's that stigma. Well, you know, you're a man. Especially if you're getting assaulted by another man, then there's that stigma of, you know, what that might be perceived as, and all of that. So you might be less likely to report. But I really would be interested in wondering if the military, if one of the next steps would be to break it down as far as, you know, categories, race, ethnicity, because that would be really, really telling, not only for the next steps, the steps that they need to take, and for for reporting and for the support, how to support the victims of sexual assaults.
I wonder, like, I'm not sure how the U.S. military works, but I wonder if behind the scenes they actually do have these numbers, but they don't reflect well on the military, so they choose not to publish them. Because if you're breaking it down and you're showing that these sexual assaults happen at a far greater degree to persons of color, then you've got an issue of racism within the military, and you're showing that you can't then protect Black women or potentially Black men either. So it may reflect negatively on the military. So if they have that information, they may have a vested interest in keeping that close to the vest.
Absolutely. And that's exactly what I was thinking. I said, well, because we already know that they're making certain information available and then certain information is kept a secret, then how do we know that this is also not being kept a secret? Because this may be opening the door to a lot of other stories and speculations as it relates to what is really happening. And so many scholars that I did look at have this type of opinion on it. You know, so what does it look like if we did know those numbers? And why, if they knew that there's issues related to racism, you know, just in the out here in the general population, then why not break it down so that we have all the facts?
Exactly. And like, I worry about this too, with regards to the military is trying so hard to have these certain type of optics with regards to inclusivity. When it comes to, you know, persons of color, gay people, trans individuals, they're saying we're inclusive, we welcome all of these people. But I also question how well they can protect these individuals and how apt they would be to share any information that shows otherwise.
And I can't tell you that I'm completely convinced that they're doing that they're doing their level of best to protect individuals. I think that it may be more either the photo op or even the PR, right? Because that is the hot thing to do right now, to be able to just put out that press that says that, you know, we believe in equity and inclusion and all of the buzzwords that we have right now, particularly as, you know, the way the United States, we're navigating a very interesting period of racial and ethnic and instability per se, also in the middle of a pandemic. And I'm not exactly convinced that they're doing their level best with that. And specifically when we look at the way Black women are treated, particularly because this is a case about a Black woman, a young Black woman, I am of the opinion that we should believe Black women. As a Black woman, I tend to believe Black women. And so I think that there's more to this story. I think that this young woman was very clear on who she was, and her parents were clear on who she was. And this narrative of a suicide is totally speaking against that.
It is. And like, I've heard from so many women that I've known that have been in the U.S. military. Like, I'm obviously not even American, so I can't speak to the experience of women in the military. But every single woman that I spoke to said that you don't want to speak out. You don't want to be that person. You don't want to rock the boat. And so you live with, you know, the few women I've spoken to and have spoken about sexual assaults. And these were white women, right? So I can imagine even being a Black woman, it would be even harder because you've got to overcome like a patriarchal institution. You've got all of these white men at the top. It's hard enough for women, and it's so much harder if you're a person of color. So absolutely. Lavina, in this situation, being kind of thrust into what her father feared, you know, like Dr. Johnson knew this was going to be rough for his daughter, because not only is she a woman, but she's also a Black woman, and she's around all of these, you know, testosterone fueled young men. And that's just the age. I'm not saying just military men are testosterone fueled. It's about being, you know, 18, 19, 20. I'm sure most people can think back to that time. It's just, it wouldn't be the healthiest environment. And I think that she thrived given the circumstances and the situation, but I can understand why her parents were so scared for her.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's a part in the case that also speaks to what you're talking about, where there was the part where they said, well, she worked behind the desk and she wasn't as respected by her colleagues because she was so soft-spoken. And the response was of her superior was to say, well, maybe you need to speak up a little bit more and not be so soft-spoken. So then they put the responsibility on her. So and it speaks to the broader, I think it speaks to the broader issue that is happening in the military or with the workplace in general, where if a woman is being harassed or, you know, taunted, for example, the responsibility is always on the woman. So you have to speak up. You have to dress this way, dress that way, or smile this way. Don't smile. You're smiling too hard. It's never on the perpetrator to say, hey, maybe we need to have some training or a conversation needs to take place to say, no, but you don't do that to these people. You don't taunt anybody. You know, you don't speak to anybody that way. The responsibility should be on the perpetrator, not necessarily on the person that is receiving the ill treatment. And so to me, not only is it a reflection of the military, but it's a reflection of the wider society, right? And again, it's again the fear of retaliation. So if you go to, you know, in the civilian world, you can go to the HR and then you fear retaliation, you fear you're going to lose your job. In the military, you fear that your superior, if you go above your superior's head, then you fear your superior coming back to you and saying, oh, you try to get me in trouble, and or the consequences that could be. So that can be mental, emotional, and physical. So there's even, you know, I think it's a more dangerous threat because you're in this wall of secrecy that is the military, this wall of secrecy and threat and just danger, because it just stays there, you know, in these protective walls, so to speak.
Oh, I think you hit the nail on the head. The military isn't just like this separate institution that's so different from society. It's like a microcosm of what's going on in America. And sure, certain things might be overrepresented, but if something's happening in the military, it's definitely happening in a broader context, like in all of America, like on the macro level, right? I mean, to call the military micro, I know sounds ridiculous, but as compared right. to the entire US as a country, it's just so frustrating because we know all of these things are happening. And we know that, especially with regards to women, I wish we had more information on these statistics. Like, I had all of these questions about, you know, Black women in the military, and we can't answer these because we just don't know how any of these assaults or, you know, suspicious deaths are broken down with regards to race. And that's so, so frustrating because I feel like we would have an incredible insight into what's going on if we broke things down with regards to sexual orientation and gender and race. Absolutely. And yeah.
But it's not in the military's interest to divulge that information. I agree with you that information to a certain degree may exist. We just not privy to it. But I think that unlike the, you know, the society in general, the military has a certain level of protection, you know, of intel and information that society in general may not have. Another layer of protection, right? That certain corporations might not have, which is interesting. But I really think that it speaks to the degree that we respect Black women, that we respect, that we believe what Black women are saying, that we believe when they are in danger. And to the degree that I also think that this was a homicide and an assault first, that how we view Black women's bodies as objects. We objectify Black women's bodies and that we can discard it as we see fit. Or maybe it was retaliation for something else. I'm not exactly sure why she was murdered. But if I think about the many different reasons that Black women are murdered, these are some of the first things that come to my head.
So we spoke a bit about Lavina's potential state of mind, and you brought up her talking to her parents, wanting to go home for Christmas. So in the military files, they brought up things like, you know, she was eating more ice cream and all of these sorts of things. And some people did note that Lavina was depressed. But in speaking about this, just because somebody is dealing with things while they're overseas, while they're deployed in this really hot place, you know, there was a dissolution of a relationship, just because someone's feeling that way doesn't automatically mean that they're going to go and complete suicide in a bizarre manner and that that's the explanation. I think you can have both situations. You don't automatically go, oh, she's dealing with some stuff. Oh, must have been suicide.
Yeah, I'm not totally convinced that was it. So if she was going through a phase of depression or whatever it may be, then there should have been more evidence towards that. She would have been speaking to more people, or particularly, I'm sure that they had professionals that, you know, she could resort to. And she seemed to have, again, I go back to her relationship with her parents. How come they didn't know that something was going on? There should have been at least a glimpse. Maybe she wasn't comfortable to say, well, I'm fully depressed or whatever's going on. But they could have, you know, gotten a glimpse into her state of mind. And these stories are just scattered. You know, they're just scattered. They're these accounts, I should say. These accounts from the different people. They're just scattered. And I'm wondering, who really are these? Are these really her friends that are telling these story, these accounts? Like, who are these people?
And one thing that I stuck to as well with this is we're going off of all these different things, all these events that happened. And we know, or we're told in these accounts of these individuals, this roommate of this guy and the guy that she was last with, they went to the PX, the fast food store, apparently, or the fast food place. I think it was Burger King. And she apparently said something to him about, like, was he afraid to meet God or something? And he asked her if she was suicidal, according to him. And she said, no, she's got too much to live for. And then he says he gets back at a certain time. And we're relying on the military's timelines. And it seems like that we at least can question if some of these things are fabricated, or at the very least, there's some hidden or missing variables. There's some statements that are missing. There's a ton of information that seems to be left out. So if we're questioning that, I think it's fair that we question this timeline for time of death, when she was last seen, when her body was discovered, and if these people were potentially pressured into making these statements.
Everything is up for grabs and up for questions. That's how I feel about this situation, given the facts. This is, you know, my feelings after reading what's been presented to me. And this particular, these two young people, who the one that was the roommate of the person and the one that was walking with her, I want to hear more from them. I don't think we have enough. And what happened to them? Where are they? Granted, sure, we don't have their names. We're not privy to their names. But what more did they say? You know, and why were they talking about meeting God? What transpired in that conversation? Again, as you said, we're having pieces here, but we don't have a full picture of her state of mind. We have little snippets of what could be, because this is what these people have said, but we have no concrete, well, this is what was happening days leading up to it. I don't know. It just does not make sense. It just doesn't.
It doesn't make sense. It's utterly incomplete. And I can see why the family is so frustrated, because they're seeing one thing, and then what the information they're being given, like, the questions aren't probative. These statements aren't complete. It's like, you find out that the last person Lavina was with, don't you have a million questions for this guy? Especially when you find out from the roommate that he said he kissed Lavina. So there was some romantic interest. And I'm not saying that he's the one that did this, but it oftentimes when a woman is raped and murdered, it's by somebody that she knows.
That's right on. And so, but we also know about a boyfriend back home. Is there a boyfriend back home? Or
he was a basic training. So this is another confusing element. So this guy, she said, was a boyfriend, but then they interviewed this guy and he said they just slept together once. I don't know if this guy was just a jerk who was trying to get something out of Lavina. And then once he did, he was like, okay, on to the next, because she apparently tried to call him and he just stopped taking her calls. And his friend was like, he's got a new, like, quote unquote friend or whatever.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if this is the individual who is responsible for transmitting this STD to Lavina. I'm not sure if this is a guy, because she spoke pretty openly about her friends and, like, they list this as being a big deal. This was treatable. I don't think this was a big deal. I don't think this was something that Lavina was, like, shameful about and hiding, because she was talking to her friends about it. She was being responsible and getting it treated.
Right. I honestly believe that the answer, many answers lie with these young men that last saw her, particularly this one that was walking with her and what happened. And I have a question. Aren't there, and I know you're the one who asks the questions, but I'm wondering about cameras in the facilities. So are there no cameras that monitor? Was there any video that shows around base or anything like that, or no? I mean, is there any conversation of that?
Not to my knowledge. I don't think that there is any video cameras, at least at the time. There might be now. I'm really unsure. And even if there is, they've obviously not released that information. But you'd think that there would be, because the military is ultimately responsible for every single person on that base.
And absolutely.
The fact that they didn't know certain information, and we've got inconsistencies and stories that feel like, okay, when someone enters a building, at the very least, there should be a camera there, right? So you see who's entering and exiting.
Right.
And the guy who was with Lavina last said that he walked her to her building. And then the roommate said he walked her halfway there. So just little inconsistencies like that, right?
Yeah, there are little inconsistencies, but I think that's where the real answers lie. That's where, you know, that's what we need to dig deep into. And that's where the military owes this family some answers on exactly what happened. These young people need to be talked to. And you know what? I'm sure they've been talked to. We're just not getting the information. It just does not make sense.
When you've got this guy who was last with her, apparently saying to the roommate something like, I didn't have sex with her, I only kissed her, but I'm okay with that. It's a weird statement, and I'm not saying he's responsible for anything, but wouldn't you want to dig deeper and be like, what exactly happened between you? What type of romantic relationship did you have? What sort of feelings did you have for Lavina? Were you hoping for more out of this? And maybe she wasn't willing to give it to you. Like, these questions aren't asked, and why?
And if we go by the injuries that she did have on her person when she was found, we know that an assault took place. I don't think she assaulted herself. And clearly with all the fires, I mean, clearly there was a cover up. Someone was trying to cover up something. And I'm not sure.
And like, why would she put herself under a bench and start multiple fires? And what was the need, if she was burning pages, to use an accelerant? Like, none of this stuff fits.
It just doesn't. And so it to me, it just, you know, it's frustrating because we're saying, you know, this is the United States military here. This is supposed to be the cream of the crop, the best military in the world. You're telling me we're supposed to believe that this is exactly what happened. This is the account, and we're going to stick with this. Like, absolutely not. This is not it. And you're expecting the family to believe this. You know, you're basically saying that these people, like these bodies are not as important as others. And if we get into the conversation about race and gender, again, you're saying that Black bodies are just not as important. We're just going to go ahead and call it a suicide, or that women in general, right? That Black women, and that these people don't deserve answers, because they just don't. They're not as important. So we're just going to throw the word of suicide at it and call it a day. What would happen if this was a family that did not ask as many questions as the Johnsons? You know, this is a huge concern of mine. What would happen if this was a family that did not have history of military service, for example, or didn't have the academic background that Dr. Johnson has to know that, you know, something is funny here? Like, we know our child, this is not it. And then we look at the evidence. This is definitely not it. Imagine how many times this has happened to other families, right? To other women in general, and other women of color and their families. And they've just simply said, well, this was a suicide. And they've actually taken that as fact and continue to grieve their loved ones. But in the back of their minds, I bet they still have questions. But my daughter or my son, they were so loving and they were so upbeat. There's no way. Like, I can totally see a parent who's lost a child, right? And whose death has been ruled a suicide, but who might have some questions in the back of their heads. Was it really? I'm not sure. So again, it's just thinking about this case, but I'm also thinking more broadly about other people, other families who've lost loved ones, and the uncertainties of what they were told that actually happened to them.
And I think you nailed it. The fact that Dr. Johnson has this background, he has a history of military service. That's why he felt comfortable asking the questions and saying no when pressure was applied. Like, hey, you should get her cremated, or, you know, you should have a closed casket. And then when they see the body, it's like, eh, like you're clearly trying to cover something because there isn't as much damage as we thought there was going to be. Certainly doesn't look like an M16 did this. And how do you explain this? These cuts, abrasions, and this broken and reset nose? We've got gloves glued on the hands.
Yes.
And that's not even touching on what was happening with Lavina's vagina and her anus, the missing section of tongue.
Just on that alone, just on the mutilation of her body, right? The way her body was toyed with and played with, again, the objectification of this woman's body, as if she was nothing, of her body parts. That in itself is a red flag, right? And the attempts to the burning, I do not see that. I don't see her doing that herself. And as you said earlier, how and why would she put herself underneath a bench if she's just simply trying to, you know, to say, this is it, I'm ending my life right here.
And we've even got inconsistencies with regards to the M16, like people saying it was over her left shoulder. We've got like early oral reports saying it was that she was face down, so it wouldn't have been in that position. No eyewitnesses said that, but ear witnesses said they'd heard that. And then in the sketch in the military's file, you see the M16 a great distance away from her body. So right. There's some glaring inconsistencies. They just don't seem to line up, and there's no accounting for as to why.
And then we wonder why people are livid, why her family is absolutely just furious, and why they continue to fight. And I don't see them letting up, because This is absolutely ridiculous. The facts are speaking for themselves. This is not just you and I speculating. This is just too much there that just makes complete sense that, you know, it almost makes me believe that if they do go ahead and talk about this case and really factually talk about what happened, that would actually set a precedent and it would open the can of worms that the military might not be ready for.
No, and I think it's the same reason that they don't publish statistics based on, you know, gender, sexual orientation, and race, because then you're going to have people who are going to establish some hierarchy of importance where you've got, okay, well, we've got wealthy white men at the very top of this pyramid. And then as we go down, you know, we've got white men who are, you know, a little less affluent, and then we've got queer white men, and then, you know, we're going to have women, and then so on and so forth down until you get to the bottom, when it's going to be women of color, right? And persons of color.
That's it. You know, and let the hierarchy continue on how we treat people, right? Mm-hmm. It's completely insane. It is.
It's like if you keep it more convoluted and you keep it hidden behind all of these layers of secrecy, it's almost like it didn't happen. And I feel like that's the stance they're taking. And people are at least asking the questions and going, this doesn't make sense.
And, you know, it didn't happen. We know it happened secretly and we can still control it. Well, let me tell you something. I think things are changing. It might be a little bit slower changing in the military as they do in civilian life, but I think things are changing. I think the powers that be inside that wall of secrecy are scared because they do realize things are changing. And this wall of silence, eventually something is going to happen. And I honestly believe that in my lifetime, this is going to happen. And the truth will come out on this and many other cases, and things will change, right? Because if you believe that at the very basic level, the military is there to protect this country and others, right? And to give young people an opportunity, which is why Lavina decided to go in the military, right? To give, it shows her character because she wanted to not be a burden to her family financially. She wanted to go ahead and go to college and serve her country as her father had, right? And she deserves honesty and she deserves a respectful legacy, right? It's one thing that, again, if there were questions and we knew that suicide, yes, this is what happened, but I think that we are doing wrong by her. By allowing that to be, the military is doing absolutely wrong by her by allowing that to be her legacy on this earth as it relates to the military. That is, that's a huge disservice.
No, I 100% agree. And I think with regards to a culture shift in the military, I'm optimistic that it will happen, but it's going to take time, I think, because you've got all of these people at the very top who are basically at the helm, and those people are responsible for everything that trickles down. And until you get more diversity at the top, you've got more women at the top, you've got more persons of color who are going to be in those key power positions. I don't think you can affect real change across the military until the leadership changes. There's a change of the guard.
Absolutely. It's going to take generations. And provided that these generations, as you said, have a different mindset, right? Different backgrounds and different ways of thinking and different leadership styles, right? And again, and I get it, it's difficult because it's still the military. But I'm hoping, I'm optimistic that I'm hoping that even if it's later in my lifetime, that towards the end of my lifetime, I can see it for the sake of all the women and men that serve, not only in the U.S., but across the world. But if we're talking about the United States being a global example, right, of security and all of that, then we need to be setting the example, particularly by starting in-house. And that's why I believe that this family deserves better than what the military has given them.
Yeah, Lavina deserves to have her legacy be that of, we've got justice for Lavina. And even if the investigation showed them that she completed suicide, which I don't believe with, you know, correct. I've got no shred of doubt that, you know, somebody did this to her. But had they done a thorough investigation, they could at least say, hey, these are the facts. This is what we've uncovered. It definitely points towards this. But what we've got is a really incomplete military report with all of these kind of, like you mentioned, scattered testimonies. And did you get a chance to read the letters from the senators and the congresspeople who basically in support of Senator Lacey Clay and in support of the Johnson family said to, like, I think it was the Secretary of Defense, and they were like, hey, you need to investigate this because something's not right here.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, but that's how things have to be. And it's so frustrating, to be very honest with you, that you have to continuously knock on the doors of the high powered folks in order for the military to listen to you, you know, the senators. I mean, I guess that makes sense, but we just don't believe the voice of the people. It's infuriating to me that it has to take, let's enlist as many elected officials as possible. But even if these folks, even if these people are able to say, listen, I'm reading this and it's clear as day, like, hello, like this, what are we doing here? You know, these are elected officials. We elected them. They're respected, right? Or for the most part, do something. But they're not even moved by that. I don't know. I want to be optimistic that things in the military will change eventually later. But I'm conflicted on whether or not they're going to give this family justice.
I really hope that they will. But I feel like the military feels like, okay, we've already got a closed case here. And as far as optics are concerned, we've got scenario A, people are screaming out for justice and answers, or we've got scenario B, and then we do investigate this properly. We realize that Lavina was raped and murdered. And then there's this broader question about, can you protect women in the military and can you protect Black women in the military? So I don't Correct. Know which scenario is better. I think that they're more likely to choose scenario A, where they're just Right. like, hey, we've been saying nothing. Let's just continue to say nothing.
Because we're just going to be lazy about this. We're going to be, you know, the scenario A is the easy way out, because then, you know, we can wash our hands of the responsibility to do right by this group of people that continue to experience these hardships and that are traumatized for life. You know, some of the stories that I've read on how drastically, particularly because we were focused on women, particularly Black women, I'm reading the stories of what this means for women when they come out of the military and how this affects their life. It's disheartening, you know? But then you do hear about the survival stories that sort of give you a little bit of hope. The women that come out and are really stuck to the fight and form these organizations, and they want to help women that are faced with this in the military. And, you know, they form support groups and awareness groups and education groups as well, organizations. And so that gives me that hope. But women, no one should be going through this. That's not what you're signing up for. You're not signing up for sexual assault. You're not signing up to be treated as badly as Lavina was, as badly as, you know, just, you know, worse than animals. That's not, you're not signing up for that. You're signing up to serve your country, to learn a skill, to be proud, and so on and so forth. That is not what Lavina signed up to be.
No, that's definitely not what Lavina was sold when she signed up. When the fact that women are all coming together and connecting and sharing their stories, although I love that, I think it's great and it's empowering, but the fact that they need to do it is a reaction to the situations that they're put in and the lack of protection that they're given in the military. And if people say, oh, well, you know, there's people they can talk to or this or that, women are shamed into their silence. In regular civilian life, it's even worse in an institution like the military. And you work in an educational institution. I spoke about this in my main episodes, but we spoke about how educational institutions, like the documentary, The Hunting Ground, you see how they just poo-poo women's experiences and they put all the onus and responsibility on the victim and none on the perpetrator. Like you spoke about earlier, like the victim shaming and blaming is just too much.
Absolutely. And it continues, you know, I've had a couple of personal experiences at my own university where I felt ignored, right? And also having to advocate for students on behalf of students who also were ignored when situations happened. And, you know, it's just so widespread. And again, we're putting the responsibility on the victim to just, you know, on the folks who are victimized. Let me say this because it's a verb. They're not victims, but they're victimized. Because we need to put the responsibility on the perpetrator. There's, you know, there's such blame and shame put on the victim to, well, you should have done that. You should have, well, how about folks should not be assaulting folks? How about folks learn that there's a way that you behave, or if you have anger issues, or if someone doesn't want your attention, that you don't give it to them in a forced way and walk away? These are the conversations that need to happen instead of, or your shorts were too short, or your skirt was, but your pants were too tight. No, that is not the conversation. It's mind-boggling, and we continue to focus on that. So even in the military, one of the things that I read was, well, when you tell the newer members of the military, oh, don't ask to be housed over there because you're clearly going to be sexually assaulted. That shouldn't be the case. You should be telling somebody that there's something happening in that unit or in that building. There's these things happening there. That shouldn't be, oh, that house or that unit is known for these things. Yeah, it's absolutely crazy to me.
It shouldn't be happening. And you've got, like, we hope that we've come this long way since cases like, you know, Dr. Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas and Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky, where all the blame was put on these women. But you see the same thing in situations like that. Oh, don't wear that. Don't behave like that. Rather than focusing on how you're raising these men that are then victimizing women, because it starts with how they're being parented, how those young men are being treated. The onus needs to be on parents and it needs to be on educators to be teaching these young men how to behave and to take a certain modicum of responsibility with regards to how they're treating women and their conduct out there in the world.
Absolutely. But then, you know, some of these folks are being raised in powerful families, right? So they may come from more powerful socioeconomic status, and then they are raised to think that for somehow their opinion and their wants and desires transcends the rest of the world, or that women should be at their beck and call. And they walk around with like this global arrogance of sorts that everyone should just be catering to them. And that's exactly what we see in the cases of, as you said, Clinton, Thomas, Kavanaugh, where, again, we don't believe women. We do not believe women when the evidence is there. We look at Clinton, we look at Thomas, Kavanaugh. It is clear as day, but we still choose to go ahead and put these men in office.
Trump.
Hello. That, of course, that's the biggest elephant in the room that I just didn't even want to go there. But since you said the T word, you know, and hey, we're just going to go about life. And to me, what's even crazier as a feminist, but as a Black feminist, to think that there are women who are voting for them, supporting them, completely blinded, you know, over that power, and speak ill of the women that are accusing them. The women that are literally saying, listen, these men are okay being like regular people in society, but they're about to make decisions that affect all of us at a global level. This is not it. These are sexual predators. They shouldn't be running no one's life or decision-making, not even a country, decisions that are going to affect people, millions of people. That's a problem.
Yeah. Like, is there nobody better to put in power that isn't problematic with regards to all of this history and women coming forward about with regards to sexual assault? And are we questioning the credibility of every single woman? I think that we need to believe women when they're saying this, because it's a very minute percentage of women that fabricate these accounts. People people want to say like, oh, she's out there for financial gain or notoriety. I don't think people come forward saying they were sexually assaulted for notoriety or for money in most instances.
The amounts of stuff that you have to face from the media that has nothing on the money or whatever it is. No one wants to be put in that position, I don't think. Particularly, you know, a woman who's been victimized to that degree. So again, the end result of these cases and this particular case that we're talking about still speaks, it screams volumes loudly that we still don't believe women. Even when the evidence around her, speaking of Lavina, even when the evidence around her is saying there's something crazy, foul happening here, we still don't believe it and we put the blame on her. No, nobody killed her. This was a suicide. So again, you know, Anita, we don't believe her. Monica, we don't believe her. I forget the woman who accused Kavanaugh. We don't believe her either. And Lavina, no, this was all her doing. She wanted to end her life and here it is.
And like, we looked up methods that women use to complete suicide, and setting oneself on fire, it was less than 1%. And that's when that's the primary method used, right? If that's the methodology of which you choose to complete suicide. Well, Lavina chose, if you are to believe the military's narrative, which I clearly do not, but she would have chosen to use a gun. So these fires would have been secondary. So it doesn't even make sense why somebody would be setting these fires, apparently setting themselves on fire. And it's just so confusing because we don't have access to the autopsy. Like, obviously not a pathologist, but I would have liked to have asked a pathologist, like, what's your opinion on this? Because there's the wound stat or the potential use of the wound stat and the burns that were potentially lie. Like, we were trying to discuss that and Mel was explaining wound stat and she's like, well, you know, if you pour something like wound stat somewhere that is moist, like a vagina, it will harden most likely, right, to a cement-like substance. Whereas pouring it just on skin, she's like, I don't know. I don't think it would react. It needs moisture to react. So was there lye used or was there just accelerant and wound stat? It's just so weird, but it seems like that wound stat was potentially put inside her or on her vagina to hide evidence of a sexual assault. Like, why else would it be used?
This is something that I meant to mention early. Everything that you're saying, all these different, this shows someone who has knowledge, you know, of what to do with the materials that were there around Lavina, who had access. To me, this doesn't seem like something that she would do. It seems like a superior or someone who may know, who has studied this, who knows what these particular chemicals are going to do to these particular areas of the body. If I put a glove on this young woman, this is what I'm doing. If I pour this chemical on her, this is what's happening. So to me, this was calculated to a certain degree, perhaps not premeditated, but calculated in the way that, okay, oh, shoot, I killed this young woman. Now I have to figure out how to. So for me, it just seems like someone who knew where stuff was. So if it wasn't this young man or these young men, it had to be someone like a superior who might know what the different chemicals, because there was just too much knowledge there and too much knowledge of what was done to her, vaginal area, the gloves in her hand, like all of that. And the burning, it just seems like someone had greater knowledge of utilizing all those combinations.
And I think at least it opens up the potential that maybe there was more than one offender, or at least when it comes to the cover-up part of it, it feels like there would have had to be more than one person involved if we're to believe the military's timeline, because it's a pretty short timeline of events. And you've got things like her Bible missing. The first one third of her diary pages are missing. And even the details there, like we talked about this on the main episodes and it bothered us. So is this the first one third of her written pages? Like say she's filled a diary one half of the way and they've ripped out one third of the written pages.
Right.
You can see. So right. Is it one third of total pages or one third of the pages that have been written on? And there's no clarification. And it's so frustrating. Like why?
Again, a lot of whys, my friend, a lot of whys and not enough, because this was, the details are just not there. And I bet the military is getting it. I'm sure at the time they were getting extremely frustrated with the questions. We are not the first people, and we certainly will not be the last asking all these questions. And this is going to have to hang over their head for quite a while.
Oh, I'm sure. And like when we were talking about the investigation, Mel's like, the military is nothing if not organized and detail oriented.
So correct.
When you look at like the lack of detail in this report, we're certainly missing statements. I totally believe that they did ask all of those questions that we're saying that they should have asked, but I just don't think that it's included in the official report. I think they cherry picked whatever that they wanted, just my opinion, to support their narrative. And maybe they threw in a few things that would maybe counter that, so it looked a little more honest or genuine. And then at the end of the day, you've got this incomplete report where they're asking zero probative questions. You're just getting statements and they're not following up on things like you're the last romantic interest of Lavina. And we're just not going to ask you any questions. We're just basically going to take it at your word.
And this is what they decided, that they were going to feed the family, feed the rest of us, and that we were going to take it, that they were going to take it and just, hey, it's okay. We ask no questions. That they were going to go ahead and take this report, have a closed casket funeral service, or even before that, go ahead and cremate her, you know, just telling this family on how to mourn or how to, you know, have the homegoing ceremony of their loved ones. It went terribly wrong because they said, no, there's some red flags here. You're going to have to answer some questions. And we're not going to slow down until you do. Keep putting the pressure.
How do you feel about the rape kit? Like the lack of the rape kit being done?
That to me is probably one of the biggest red flags. If you put that to in the same level with what was done to her vaginal area and her anal area, clearly there's something there. And do we really believe that a rape kit was not done?
That's what they're saying, but I don't believe half
everything
of what
is up for questioning, right?
It's so true. They may already have that information. They may know, like, you know, I think most people that look at this case, myself included, believe that Lavina was sexually assaulted. So do they know who did
Absolutely.
This?
Absolutely.
I think there's a pretty good idea that they know who did this.
Mm-hmm.
And that they just went, okay, like, let's look at the ends justifies the means. This is for the collective good. This is not good for optics. So we just have everybody suck it up and we maybe privately reprimand these people in some way, but we don't kick them out because we don't want to make it look like this is a reaction or a punishment, because then maybe they'll say something and this will get out and we just put up our walls of silence and nobody says anything.
Right. It draws attention if these people are, you know, expelled or whatever. No, there's a couple of things that absolutely I agree with you on, that potentially more than one person committed this crime, that she was sexually assaulted because there was trauma to her vaginal area. There was cover-up trauma in addition to her potentially being, there was the contusions on her face or the parts of her body. I mean, there's just, yeah, I definitely think that someone was, if they didn't sexually assault, they were trying to. And she said, hell no. And it went terribly south. And then someone got some help in covering it up. This young woman did not commit suicide I will stand on that, period.
Yeah, I will die on that hill. I don't believe that Lavina completed suicide. I think there's no way. And it doesn't, it feels like maybe rape was premeditated, but I don't feel like the murder was premeditated. I feel like that was in the moment. And then it was a scramble to cover it up and stage the scene, because we've got things that are left out, like the potential blood outside the tent that Dr. Johnson mentions. And maybe there was blood inside the tent, or the footprint inside the tent that may have been bloody. But he's getting this, I believe, from some kind of inside credible source, because I've got nothing to corroborate that outside of his opinion. But I believe everything that Dr. Johnson says. I think he's an incredibly, he's a man of integrity. He's not going to go and fabricate things. So when he says something, I listen.
And, you know, and I think he feels really betrayed by the military that he served, you know, because his daughter, for all intents and purposes, I'm going to say she was legacy. You know, she was a legacy, admit, you know, well, she got there on her own merits, of course. But the fact that he was former military and was proud of it, and his daughter wanting to follow her father's footsteps for her progress in life, I think that to a certain degree, he might feel really let down by the military, that he was more loyal to a military that was not loyal to him and his family. That saddens me, you know, for him. And I would be really curious to hear about how he feels about the military and the service that he, the time that he spent in the service.
Did you watch The Silent Truth?
Yes. Did he talk about that?
I think he was pretty harsh on the, I think he's pretty harsh on the military, but I don't think he talked super in detail. Like, he was just like calling them out. You know what I mean? Like,
yes, he was. Yeah.
And I think it was pretty brave of him, because he was in the military for so long, still worked for the military, but in a civilian capacity. And so I think he was in a unique position that so many families should be able to be in, but they just aren't. We're told from young ages to trust these institutions, that these are institutions of integrity, of truth, of justice, be it the police, be it, you know, the military, be it educational institutions. We're taught those things. And so when they tell us something like your daughter died, she completed suicide, I think most families are going to go, the military says it's true. Okay, I'll accept that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So do you have any final thoughts on the case or hopes for the future with regards to the Johnson family getting justice?
Absolutely. I will argue that this family will not, they will spend every time of day that they can and have available to them to get justice for their daughter. I don't think that they will slow down. I think that they will still seek justice. I think that as a result of this and all the other cases that are coming up, the military has no choice but to make some changes. But as we talked about earlier, it's not going to happen in 10, 20 years. It's not. It will have to be a generational shift in culture, the culture of doing things, the culture of holding folks accountable, the culture of who has power in the military and what that power actually looks like as it relates to the identity, the different, the intersectional identities of people, and holding those who commit these heinous crimes against other fellow military personnel accountable, and not continue to victim blame and victim shame. That is the only way. And because that is such a, that's such a magnificent task, I don't think it's going to be anytime soon. But rest assured, I know that this family, Dr. Johnson and his family, will not rest until they get justice for their daughter.
That was really well said.
And I mean it. Like, I just, yeah, he's just full of fire, and I feel for him.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, the emotional toll, the physical toll that that's going to take when he doesn't have time to stop to grieve. I can only imagine like how impactful it is when you want to just break down, you know, you've lost your daughter, you should be able to do this, but instead he's put in that position. And I remember his wife saying, like, I've got to grieve for the both of us. And that just left me gutted, because it's like, this family should have the right to grieve Lavina's death.
Yes. And I don't think they have. I don't think they've properly had an opportunity to.
So in your opinion, moving forward, what do you think that the military could do to protect both Black women, women in general, as well as members of the LGBTQ plus community? Because saying they are inclusive, like we said, and accept everyone, it's not enough.
Mm-mm. No, they could start by listening to these to people from these communities and asking them what can we do to make it not a more welcoming, but to make it a space where you feel that you can thrive, right? Even if you can't make it more inclusive, because that's going to take time to create a place that is truly inclusive. But what can we do until then to create a space where you feel that you can be comfortable, right? And listen to them. Run the numbers, let the numbers, like, be clear about the numbers and ask them questions and listen to those answers and act on those answers. So one step at a time. Don't just be trying to do some DEI, some diversity, equity, inclusion work that, you know, hire somebody to come in and say, well, this is what it should look like. Absolutely not. Talk to the people that are already there that are part of these communities. I bet they've been shouting from the rooftop for years, for decades, what it is that they want. Just listen.
Yeah, it seems like it should be a decision that's made by speaking to people around them who are persons of color who have those experiences. It's just so simple as that. It shouldn't be a bunch of white people sitting in a room going, okay, like, let's throw out some buzzwords. We're going to talk about inclusion and diversity. And it's like, you aren't your words, you're your actions. And so the military can say these words all they want, but their actions show us who they truly are.
And it should be from the bottom up, not from the top down.
Absolutely. So I want to thank Dr. Teresa Lima Neves for coming on the show and talking about Lavina Lynn Johnson's case with me.
Thank you so much for inviting me. This was just my pleasure, not fun, but it was really great having the conversation with you.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much. And I know enjoyed is strange, but there's something about being able to talk through the details that makes you feel better about coming to the conclusions that you've drawn based on all of the evidence when you go through everything with somebody else and you come to these like-minded conclusions. And I think with Lavina's case, everybody who I've spoken to feels the same way. I've never heard one person be like, well, that girl obviously completed suicide. That just isn't a thing.
No, and we need to talk about it and create awareness, because we're not only giving light to Lavina's story, but to all the other stories similar to Lavina's that needs to be talked about. So the awareness in these conversations is absolutely important.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I'm going to link Dr. Teresa Lima Neves' book in the show notes, as well as her social media, so you can go and check out everything related to Teresa.
I want to thank you all for listening. I would love to hear from you all. If any of you have anything to say about the case, any thoughts, you can reach out to me at riddlemethatpod@gmail.com. Or I'm really, really active on Twitter, so please follow me. I'll follow you back at Podcast Riddle. And I just wanted to let you all know, if you're unaware, I don't have a Riddle Me That Patreon, but I have a Patreon with Dr. Ashley Wellman. So at the $3 level, you get early access, ad-free episodes. At the $5 level, there's a Jules and Ashley, where either Ashley will tell me a story or I'll tell Ashley a story. And it will be conspiracy theories solved, unsolved, kind of a little bit of everything. At the $10 level, there's a Path Went Chilly mini. So we'll have Robin joining us for that. So we're really, really excited. I will link that in the show notes. So until next time, stay safe and remember, accept nothing, question everything. Music by Jobbers.
Hey, everybody. This is Eric Carter-Landine, the host and producer of True Consequences podcast. True Consequences is a true crime and mystery podcast with stories based in New Mexico and the American Desert Southwest. I started this show to bring light to cases that need to be solved in my state. You see, my brother was murdered 33 years ago, and his murderer still walks free. So I cover cases with an empathetic lens, because I understand what it's like to seek justice for a family member. I hope you'll give True Consequences a chance. You can find me wherever you listen to podcasts.